We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
It's time for MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Host a local event and give kids in your community a chance to compete in the Pitch, Hit, and Run Finals at the 2024 MLB World Series. Sign up for free at pitchhitrun.com.
The Dan Bernstein Show. Weekdays 9 a.m. to noon on Sports Radio 670 The Score.
I know a lot of people didn't think we'd end up back in Grand Park this year. Nobody knows if we're going to be in Grand Park next year. But the one thing I do know is my heart, my soul, my love has always gone to the city of Chicago. And I do know that no matter what happens, my heart, my soul, and my love will still be in the city of Chicago.
Must appreciate his celebrity even more because he didn't have those platforms to be known worldwide. There was no ability to promote yourself through social media, to post videos, no tweets, nothing like that. He was known for his play and for having this larger-than-life persona.
That was the voice of Andrea Kramer that you heard, and you got to see her last night on the final episodes of The Last Dance, episodes 9 and 10. And she joins us now on Sports Radio 670 The Score. Dan Bernstein with Will Perdue alongside. Andrea Kramer is on Twitter at @Andrea_Kramer. Thursday Night Football on Amazon Prime, NFL Network, HBO Real Sports, CBS Sports Network. That's a lot of jobs. And she's with us on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline, Alpamonte Ford in Melrose Park. Hello again, Andrea. How are you?
I'm great, but Dan, 2 weeks in a row, people are going to start talking about us. I don't know. And hello, Will. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. Quick story. When I got traded to the Spurs, we used to stay at the Lowe's Hotel in Santa Monica, and Doc Rivers and I were down in the hotel working out, and somebody was down there working out.
Exactly, yep.
Came up and said hello to us, and we distracted her for 30 minutes and totally blew up her workout. So I would like to apologize years later.
What a memory on you by you. That's great. Yes, no, it's great to hear your voice, and wonderful to see you in the dock. So
thank you.
So what, Andrea, do you think, guys? How's it resonated in Chicago now that it's gone?
It brings back the same issues that we've had that are fundamental to the whole civic psychology of this. And it's, rather than celebrating six titles, there are still people looking to cast blame and lament the fact that it ended the way that it did. I contend firmly that this thing, that it was over, and everybody knew it was over, and that one way or another, this was going to be it, no matter what anybody wanted or presumed. But it's less a celebration of the six titles than it is a forensic examination of how and why it ended the way it did.
Yeah, I was wondering, which sort of sounds funny when you're talking about historical events, how it would end, meaning the documentary, and it was interesting to end it on sort of a big what if. Did you buy into that, Will? Here I am, Dan. I'm sorry, I'm taking over your show. I'm asking questions.
Please do. Believe me, most of the listeners would prefer that you did.
I'm sorry.
Say that again. I started laughing.
The idea of what if. And should they have come back for another season, and they all would have signed 1 year deals potentially, and go for the seventh ring? I don't know. What are your thoughts on how this documentary ended in that vein?
Well, I think it's unfortunate that that's what a lot of Bulls fans and Michael Jordan fans want to focus on. I just don't think that they truly grasp the business side of decisions that were made and the direction that they wanted to go. I feel like that the fans always want to have a villain. They want to have your superhero, and they want to have your villain. And I thought that Jerry Krause and Reinsdorf at times were seen to be the villains, but I just don't think people understand all the decisions that had to be made behind the scenes. They wanted it to have another opportunity, but I think Dan and I are in agreement that even if they gave them an opportunity, even if Jerry Reinsdorf decided to take a huge financial hit, when I say huge, I mean probably $20, $30, $40 million in salary over the salary cap to try to make this happen, I don't think that physically and mentally they would have been able to win the next year, much less possibly even get to the finals. And then if they did, you know, I'm not trying to be biased because I was on that Spurs team. You were talking about, as Michael said in the doc, a hungrier, a younger Spurs team against a very veteran on their last leg, possibly even have a spare on one of the four tires limping into the finals. I just don't think it would have happened. But people don't want to focus on that. They want to focus on the six championships and why weren't they given the opportunity to win a seventh instead of saying, hey, we got to see six championships in 8 years. Who gets to see that? We were spoiled.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And I think that I think that the idea of even accomplishing the six in the climate of sports is such an amazing accomplishment. And I don't know, I'm someone that there are no fairy tales in sports, okay? As you've mentioned, it is a business, and unfortunately fans don't always want to remember that, whether it's a situation like this or whether it's with a contractual situation, whatever it is. But if you want to believe, if you want to live in a fairy tale world, they went out on top. They went out as champions. And to your point, Will, isn't it better to go out that way than, again, to see a team possibly on the decline? And it seems almost impossible that Scotty would have come back, even though this is all conjecture on our part. But, yeah, I mean, they went out on top, and I think that that would have been something really to truly celebrate, not the what if or what could have been or things of that nature. I'm not a big fan in that way of hypotheticals, and we see exactly what happened, which was to win and to win that way. And the other thing that, as you know, Will, always gets overlooked, and the Spurs experienced it during their run, the Lakers to an extent during their run under Phil Jackson as well, is when you play in the playoffs, that's almost, you know, an extra third of the season, extra quarter of the season. So by the time you talk about six championship runs, do you know how much extra you're playing? Not to mention, oh, by the way, that in the midst of that, they also had the Dream Team and the Olympics and stuff. So what they did was just, it's beyond exhausting. And to be able to win the six, I think even against that backdrop, magnifies the accomplishment even more, in my opinion.
I also thought that we saw that last night, the very best filmmaking and storytelling in the entire series regarding Steve Kerr. And regarding his family, his father, and how they incorporated his interview with the video that they had and the history, that was just a bravura turn by the filmmakers. I thought that when all is said and done, some of the most important, significant stuff, largely because it broke from some of the Jordan narrative, and it gave us a story that I was surprised how many people didn't really know or know to that extent. That was really just wonderful filmmaking.
Right, and to that exact point, Steve over the years has been extremely hesitant, to reticent to go into his backstory about the assassination of his dad and for understandable personal reasons, but you know that's just also not, you know, Steve isn't a look at me kind of guy, and you're exactly right, and the idea of whether it's looking for deeper into, you know, the other, quote-unquote, the Jordanaires, into the other major characters that you have, whether it be Scotty or Dennis or Steve, but tying it into the pivotal moment of their Bulls career, as they did with Steve, that's masterful storytelling and weaving through this personal narrative along with the team narrative. So, you know, I really appreciated that as well. And I thought it was terrific. And also tying in the notion of the fact that both Steve and Michael's dads had been murdered, and this, you know, what this kind of bond, unspoken bond that they certainly had, according to Kerr, they never talked about it, as he indicated. But, yeah, I thought that that was really, really, really compelling. But, again, listen, I think we talked about this a little bit, Dan. I love that young people get to see the caliber of basketball that Jordan in particular, the Bulls in general, were playing at that time. You know, certainly even going back to the Pistons series and the physicality that, you know, you just don't, in my opinion, you just do not see in the game today, and how they were able to navigate through that and navigate through the Jordan rules. But also, you know, you have that, but to me, I think what really resonates for people are the personal stories. And look, you know, the lasting image is still going to be at from last week's shows of Jordan just sobbing on the ground, you know, after he won the title, the first title that he won without his dad. So those images are so strong. And then, of course, the storytelling, as you point out, exemplified by Steve Kerr.
Let me ask you a question. Oh, go ahead, Will.
Go ahead, Dan. I'll wait. Go ahead.
Yeah, Andrea, I want to talk to Andrea Kramer, the journalism teacher, for a moment here, because you have lectured before on various subjects. If right now someone said, look, take The Last Dance, however you want to do it, whether it is Life and Times kind of thing or about the way they told the stories, if you had to teach a course using The Last Dance as a template, how would you do it? What would be important to you about lessons from either what we saw in it or how it was made, any and all of it? How would you use this as a teaching tool?
Okay, so I teach graduate school in journalism program at Boston University, and it's a 15-week course, so I can't begin to talk about how I would handle something like this. But that being said, for the sake of time, look, the storytelling aspect is very strong, and to be able to bring up these personal narratives and tie them into the narrative of this run that this historic run that this franchise made was very deft storytelling as well. I know that just feedback that I've heard from various people is that the timeline, the going from the then to the now and from the final championship run going back, confuses some people a little bit, and you really have to be paying attention. They tried to make it as specific as possible, but, you know, again, you have to look at, if you have a 10-part series, even though there was this incredible footage that was unearthed from the NBA Entertainment Archives, that's not enough to sustain a 10-part series. So you had to have these other elements that were in there. And I think that the video was just terrific, and the access and pulling back the curtain, as we like to say in storytelling, you know, those story beats were hugely important. And to see aspects of Jordan, very unfettered things that Will, you know, saw day in and day out, but that most people didn't. And, you know, kind of the, if you excuse my language, kind of the ball-busting mentality that does exist in sports and all that, as well as, you know, the things that really resonate were the ruthless moments that Jordan had. And I think that's very telling as well. So, but I'm all about a visual person, and I'm all about show me, don't just tell me. And so I think that was one of the things that the documentary did quite well.
Andrea, you talk about the personal stories, and I, as a player, love to hear the personal stories of people like yourself. You're watching the Bulls. You're watching Michael Jordan. Was there ever when was the certain time? I mean, you guys, I know I'm part of the media now, and you talk about how good players are. Was there a specific time, whether it was something that happened during a game, a specific play, or a conversation, you had with another member of the media that you walked out of the arena that night realizing that you were witnessing greatness?
Well, I mean, there's so many different things that resonate along those lines. I mean, you know, I will just say this sort of in a bit of a tangent, but I still maintain I've only experienced this twice in my 30-plus year career. And it's very hard, and people can roll their eyes, and they can think it sounds a little esoteric here. But there's only been two times that I've witnessed being in an arena where, for lack of a better description, it's like the arena was electrified. And the first time it ever happened to me was when Jordan hit 6 3-pointers in the first half against Portland in the finals. And that was, you know, that was the shrug game, like he didn't even know. It was sitting up there and watching that was as though literally somebody had just electrified everything. It was just an incredible feeling. The only other time I've ever felt that was when the Patriots were down 28-3 in the Super Bowl and they started to come back and mount their comeback. It's the same type of feeling. So that's one thing that I remember. From a journalist standpoint, it's something that I feel pretty strongly about, and that is that, and will you witness this? Night after night, game after game, Michael would be presented with wave after wave of media from all over the world. And some people that asked good questions, some people that didn't ask the best questions. Michael always tried as best as possible to realize that maybe this is the first time you're ever covering me, or maybe you were in the back and you didn't hear me say this. So he would repeat the answers. He remained, for the most part, very calm, very professional. You know, you always saw him giving his interviews fully dressed. You know, you didn't see him in a towel or anything like that when he was in front of the media. And I've said to players today, how can Michael Jordan have been that way with the media? And then you cop an attitude, or you don't have time, or you... I just feel that there's so much to be learned for the athlete of today when you see the way Jordan comported himself in the media under circumstances that, you know, just do not exist today, even with social media today. What the pressure that Jordan was under, I mean, you could not cover a game and not have a Michael Jordan quote. I mean, of course, you're going to go to Will Perdue and you're going to go to Steve Kerr and you're going to get the really great insight, but you got to always hear from Michael Jordan. Do you know the pressure that places on you? And athletes of today should remember that, here was the greatest ever, and he managed to make time to deal with the media. And I just think it's a big lesson that big observation that I took from covering him all those years.
Did you notice a difference in Michael before baseball and after baseball? Because we as teammates, we obviously saw the difference. He was humbled. But did you guys in the media, because you weren't exposed to him as often as we were, he always had on his, as you said, his media face when he was talking to you guys, and he handled you guys very well. But did you notice a difference after baseball and how he reacted with people, but also his teammates and you, the media?
Yeah, I think two things, though, Will. I think not just baseball, and you use the perfect word, humbling him and reminding him of, I schlepped down to Birmingham and I covered him with the Barons as well. So I remember those days. And yes, there was no question that the idea of starting over and also, you know, no question, I think that baseball rekindled the love of basketball, you know, a light that had sort of expired in him. But there was also a difference with after his dad passed away. They're just and I'm sure that you've felt that as well. That was just a big, you know, such a huge void in his life. And I don't know if I shared this story with you, and if I did, my apologies, Dan. But just a very quick personal note, because Will said, you know, I had a personal, encounters with Michael. During the Dream Team in 1992, we're out in San Diego where they had their training camp. And it's in June, and my mother died. And I'm in San Diego, and I've got to fly home to Philadelphia, where I'm from. And the day that I found out she died, the next day I was sitting down for an interview with Michael Jordan. So, you know, I obviously had gotten right on a plane, and you kind of don't want to blow off Michael Jordan. So I said to Brian McIntyre of the league office, would you just please let Michael know where I'm going and or just, you know, why I'm not here? Fine. So I'm gone for a couple weeks, and I come back, and when I went back to work, I was covering the Tournament of the Americas in Portland, which was the big tune-up tournament before the Olympics. So first day there, I'm in the bowels of the stadium, and I'm walking one way, and this massive humanity is coming the other direction, this huge media scrum, which I'm assuming is Michael Jordan. So I kind of go on the outside, and I'm passing it, and all of a sudden I hear, Andrea, and I turn around, and Michael had walked out from all the media, and everybody's standing there. He's there alone. He's there apart from everybody. And he looks at me, and he goes, I just want you to know I'm really sorry about your mother's passing. I didn't even know what to say. Everybody's standing there. There's like hundreds of people standing there, and he had just walked out to tell me that. Of course, I don't even know how he managed to see me, but, you know, we think Jordan had eyes in the back of his head anyway. But I'll never forget that, because that was a very private moment, something I would not have necessarily expected from him. But when his dad ultimately did pass away, I felt that we had sort of this macabre connection. We'd both lost, you know, the person closest to us, and I'll never forget that gesture of kindness that he showed to me. That is not something that I think a lot of people in the media got to witness, and that meant a lot to me personally and professionally as well.
Wow. Were you surprised, as you mentioned some of these more personal connections and the softening aspects of some of his hard edges? I was thinking it would have maybe been nice to hear more from his kids earlier in the documentary. And I'm not calling this out as, like, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking the documentary, but I just thought, oh, all of a sudden now it left me wanting more of a little bit of Jordan the dad, that we got a glimpse of, a tantalizing glimpse of, to give some of this larger human picture of him.
I think, Dan, that Michael was not comfortable including either his first family or his current family in the documentary. His first wife, Juanita Vinoy, was not interviewed. The kids had the very, very brief appearance, as you mentioned, at the end. His current wife, Yvette, again, not interviewed. And that was, I believe, something that was I don't want to go so far as to, you know, use the word precondition or anything like that, but Jordan and Jordan's people obviously had a lot of say over this documentary, as you and I have discussed, and I think that was one of the things that was important, that Michael did not want to have his family involved, certainly to the extent that he did his basketball family, such as Will and Phil and guys like that.
Well, it certainly ended up being it was a win for Michael Jordan, if you want to use, you know, the sports terms here about winners and losers from something like this. But this was, it's the extent to which this balanced documentary storytelling and Michael Jordan vanity project, I would say, Andrew, that whatever it was, it's a thumbs up for me. Whatever this was, and however you want to categorize it, for us, for what we needed as viewers, for what we needed in the industry, this was the right thing at the right time. And I thought it was a win. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's kind of interesting, and I say this in almost a little bit of a poetic sense, we've all watched so many otherworldly aspects of Jordan's performance. And this proved that he was human, literally, in the sense that he's going to cry, he's going to get angry, he's going to get impassioned. We saw these sides of him. And you know what? He's not going to apologize. And I admire that. I think that he stayed pretty true to who he was. I've said it before, I reiterate it, and I say it with the highest of compliment, the most ruthless competitor I've ever been around in my 30-plus years of covering sports, and I say that in a very complimentary way. When you are who he was, you could act that way, and again, the notion that he said, I never, and Will could certainly speak to this a lot better than I could, but I can certainly relate to it in my profession, the idea that, as Michael said, he never asked anybody to do anything he wasn't going to do himself. Nobody was going to outwork him. He wanted you to try to match that intensity, try to match that work ethic. And I think that it was, no question, a win-win. But I do appreciate that Michael didn't go in and say, oh, well, people may have these preconceived notions of me, and I'm going to change their opinion of me. I'm going to be this nice guy. No, he wasn't a nice guy, but that's okay. He didn't need to be. He didn't want to be. He didn't want to be your friend. He wanted to be your teammate. He wanted to be someone you respected, and he wanted to be someone that you did not want to play against, and he was intimidating as in a competitor. And I loved that any slight that he could take, even if he made them up, it fueled him with this energy that was unmatched by anybody I've ever seen.
Andrea, this is all wonderful stuff. And again, appreciate you being as generous as you've been with your time. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys. And it's great to talk to you. And hopefully we'll see each other soon, not just in a gym somewhere.
I certainly hope so. And thank you for your time. It was awesome.
All right, guys. Take good care. Stay healthy and safe, everybody out there. Thank you.
You too. That is Andrea Kramer. Just terrific stuff and some fascinating stories. And with what she's saying about Jordan's competitiveness, before the show, in our pre-show meeting, Will told a story I had never heard before, going back to a practice exercise at the multiplex. And it's I want you to tell the story in with as much color as you did in the pre-show meeting, okay?
You got it.
All right, yeah, this is, you want to stick around for this one because it's fun. I never knew this, and I learned this for the first time today. It's good stuff. He's Will Perdue. I'm Dan Bernstein. 9 to noon, live and local on The Score.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odyssey podcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odyssey podcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odyssey podcast.
Brian Russell made our team in the first place through incredible effort defensively. So he earned the right to take on some of the tougher assignments, and it doesn't get any tougher than Michael.
Yeah, Brian Russell. When I was playing baseball, Utah's in town to play the Bulls. They're practicing at the facility. I go over, say hello to John and Carl. And this kid, Brian Russell, comes up to me and says, man, why you quit? Why you quit? Man, you knew I could guard your ass. I couldn't, you had to quit. I said, Carl, you need to talk to this dude, man. Nah, he's just a young rookie. But from that point on, he's been on my list.
Brian's a very playful guy, and he said things all the time. I have no doubt Michael had a number of edges that he could have sharpened for whatever reason.
On the list. You do not want to find yourself on the list. There was some really good stuff, too, talking about where Jordan said he realized he played defense on his toes and he could give him the head and shoulder fake. Truth be told, in 97, for championship number 5, when Jordan hit that shot, Russell was playing really good defense on him. It was just a good shot. He made space for himself and he hit the shot, but you didn't want to be on Jordan's list. Dan Bernstein here on The Score. Will Perdue is alongside one more time, and it's been so great, such a special thing to have this for what have become these Bulls Mondays in these odd pandemic times of the outsized meaning of the Last Dance documentary on ESPN. But when Jordan had something at which to compete, it would be all encompassing, and obviously that even applied to simple things in practice.
Oh, he really did, and you know, over these last 5 weeks, I think when it's all said and done, by Friday of this week, I think I'll probably end up, if I just average it out, I'll probably end up doing about 100 interviews, wow, including, and I use this 1 3-hour window for the last 5 weeks as one. But I'll also do, I mean, I'm doing interviews every single day, so I'm joking that I'm reliving my 15 minutes of fame in my 50s again. But I write down, as I tell different stories on different outlets, I write the stories down, so I try not to repeat them too much, Dan, but there's two of them I actually remembered last night. I don't know why it popped into my head, but I'll tell two stories here. One is, as you talk about, and they're both about competing, but at different ways of competition. The first one was, back then we had two-a-days. We had 7 straight days of two-a-days before our first preseason game, and we always had that first practice on that first Friday of October. And after the very first practice, remember the first year I was there, it was Doug Collins, and Doug wanted everybody to run a mile, and they had done this in years previous. So the first practice of the two-a-days, the morning practice, went from 10 to 12. We finished the practice, and everybody knows we used to practice at the multiplex. We then walked straight from practice to the track that was inside the multiplex there in Deerfield. The track was, I think it was 12 times around was a mile, and it was rubberized and it was very slightly banked. And they reserved it, but then because of the fact that we were coming in to run, it was almost like an auditorium. All the members from the multiplex were there that day, and they would line the balconies and they'd be inside the track on the out. I mean, they lined the track. So what we had to do was, is the guards ran in a group first, and the guards had to run the mile, I think, in 5:45 or less, 12 laps. And then the bigs, meaning the forwards and the centers, and you know, Scottie Pippen and certain members had to run with the guards. And then the bigs, power forwards, had to run it in 6 or less, and the centers in 6:15 or less. And this was after the first practice. And this is also no running shoes. This is basketball shoes. And you remember how big and clunky basketball shoes back were in the 80s and early 90s. I mean, literally straight from the basketball court to the track. Well, immediately, Dave Corzine, Brad Sellers, a couple of the other veterans were like, keep an eye on this. Watch this. This is some of the best theater you're ever going to see. And I'm like, what are you talking about? They said, well, this is something that Michael cannot beat John Paxson at. He just cannot do it. But every year he talks about how this is the year I'm going to beat John Paxson in the mile run. So the guards line up, and Al Vermeil and Eric Helen, who were the strength coaches, line up, go. And they got the stopwatch. And as you run by every lap, they call out the times. Because most guys are like figuring out, okay, 5 minutes, 45 seconds divided by 12. As long as I hit this mark every lap, I'm fine, blah, blah, blah. Well, Pax used to have this little compact running style. I mean, he looked like a little machine. And people always remember John Paxson. He used to wear those red cotton sweatpants and then the Bulls shooting shirt with a T-shirt underneath. That's what he wore every day at practice. So Pax starts out, and he obviously takes the lead, and Michael tucks in behind him. In each lap, Michael gets farther and farther behind, but you can see Michael doing the math in his head, and he's keeping an eye on Pax with his left eye as they're running the track. And all of a sudden, Dave Corzine elbows me, and he goes, this is when it happens. And Pax is just like a little machine. And as Michael gets tired, now his running style is breaking down, and he looks like one of the 7-footers. He's getting gangly. His strides are getting longer. And he now thinks that, over the last 2 laps, I can just sprint all out and literally beat Paxson. But what he forgets is Paxson can also see him as well, because now he's probably about a quarter to a third of a lap ahead. Still doesn't, I don't even think he's broken a sweat. Just head down, And literally, as Michael starts to extend his strides and as he starts to get a little closer, well, what does Pax do? He just, all of a sudden, you see his strides get a little faster, but not longer. He's still in this same running motion. And then as they hit the last lap, I mean, Michael is literally in a dead sprint. People are clapping. They're cheering. I mean, it's like the horses at the Derby. And I imagine that a lot of, you know, people had wagers going on as well. And Pax just kind of keeps turning his head just a little bit so he can see him. And he just constantly, he easily glides across the finish line. Michael's loping, literally stumbling, diving, can't catch him. Pax literally finishes the mile, turns around and just walks back, picks up his stuff and just out to his car and gone. He's not standing around gloating. He just kind of gives you that old, this is BS anyways. You know, because why do we have to run a mile? MJ's laying on the court just exhausted, barely breathed. And now he is so mad that he just, it's unacceptable. It's almost like he wants to grab Pax and be like, let's do this again, all right? But it's just one of those things that he just could not understand, and he could not understand why he couldn't beat this guy in the mile. It just, that befuddled me to be, that's kind of when I started to learn about Michael Jordan immediately. This guy, he not only does he hate to lose, that's unacceptable to him.
So how fast do the centers have to run it?
6:15 or less.
And I'm trying to picture Stacy. I mean, Stacy now is not like Stacy then, but I'm trying to picture him. And I know, and actually Bill Cartwright, I used to see him run all the time along Lakeshore Drive. And I know he probably did fine, even though you talk about big and gangly and loping. That had to be something, watching the running of the centers.
Well, it was like you saw the horses run first, the thoroughbreds. And then, as I said, you basically just saw as the bigs, it was time for the bigs out there. It was like a bunch of cows when it was time to come home for the corn. But on another note, Michael was just, he didn't understand how people could accomplish something that he couldn't accomplish from a competitive standpoint. And what I mean by that is, most everybody at the NBA played golf. And remember, back then, Nike didn't have golf equipment, didn't have golf balls. So Michael played whatever was considered the best equipment, whether it be golf balls, clubs, whatever. And I don't know if you remember back in the 90s when they had that huge earthquake in China and it pretty much shut down the country. Well, that's where all the golf balls were made. And I had a buddy of mine by the name of Scott Gump that I went to high school with that would get me all my golf balls for free. Ooh, every year when he would roll through Chicago and play in the Western Open at Cog Hill, he'd literally give me like a dozen golf balls, whatever he was playing. Well, that year that earthquake happens in China, he actually has a contract with Maxfly. And Maxfly at the time had the best ball on the market. Everybody was trying to get these balls. You couldn't buy them in pro shops. They were so popular. All the pros were playing them. You know, so a few guys still had Titleist contracts, and even some of the Titleist guys were going back and trying to play these Maxfly balls because of the distance and the spin. And I literally had like six dozen of them in my garage. And then my buddy were talking, and he's like, hey, I don't know if you heard about the earthquake, but I can't get you any balls for a while because even I can't get them. And if I run out, I'm done. And he says, I may need you to send me some of those just in case. But that never actually happened. But Michael couldn't get any. He didn't have them. So to play tricks on him, I would take one ball a day and put it in his locker so that when he ran in for practice, he would open his locker and there would be one Maxfly golf ball. And he'd be cussing up a storm going, who's putting these in my locker? What the F is going on? Who can get these golf balls? I can't even get these golf balls. And the next day I'd put another one, and the next day another one. Well, he never knew who it was until I finally admitted. And I said, hey, I got something you can't get. And he was literally like demanding me, get me those golf balls. I need those golf balls. If you can get them, that means I should have them. I need those golf balls. And I said, obviously, you don't know the same people I know. And that was, if anything, that was probably the one time I was able to hold something over Michael Jordan's head that he couldn't get.
And when you think about it, too, like when you think about the gambling that went on the golf course and how much reputationally went into those golf games and the obsession with it, if he felt like he wasn't competing on the same playing field because he was using a substandard ball, that had to have been what was going on, that the guys against whom he's competing did have the max flies. And I don't remember that time, but there, I mean, I understand that there's, it's all fad and fashion that, you know, now it's the Pro V1 that everybody's got to have their Pro V1s. And I never know if it's true or not, or if this is just like a sort of the psychological thing where things get popular. Was the Maxfly actually better?
At that time, yeah, it was. And I forget the name of the ball. I just remember because, you know, they had the specific block lettering, Maxfly.
Mm-hmm.
And my buddy, Scott Gump, who was a grinder, didn't have a lot of contracts, but he happened to get this Maxfly contract because of a friend of a friend, you know, was doing him a favor. And he didn't necessarily get, his was more of a bonus incentive contract, meaning if he placed well, he didn't get money up front, but what he got was free golf balls and as many as he wanted. And that's where I would get all my product from him, because, you know, listen, I don't care if you're an NBA guy, NFL guy, NHL guy, Major League Baseball guy. Your three favorite words are free, half price. And it's a free product. Plus, at the time, it was, according as you talked about, a fad. But according to all the write-ups, at the moment, because of the dimple design, and you know, it would stop quicker on the greens. It wouldn't fade or hook as much as other balls. It was just at the time, and I don't know how long it was the hottest ball, but it was long enough to where I could taunt him by putting those balls in his locker.
We're talking with Will Perdue. He is sitting in today. I'm Dan Bernstein on 9 a.m. to noon on Sports Radio 670 The Score, reacting to the final two episodes of The Last Dance on ESPN. So many little details, so many things, so much gets remembered and discovered. But the fact that you mentioned golf, did you watch the golf tournament yesterday, the exhibition?
I did. I literally played yesterday. And the first thing that we were talking about when we finished playing was that, all right, now it's time to go home and watch a live sporting event, actually watch golf. And I did not play very well because I'm currently in Louisville. And I said, now it's time to go home and learn how we're supposed to play this game properly.
Well, don't watch Matthew Wolf. I don't know how I don't know how he does that. But, man, that's really quite a thing, the way he takes that club back. But having live sports yesterday, I missed it. I thought it was great, and it ended up being so dramatic at the way it ended with Rory on the last shot and draining that thing, or putting it 13 feet inside of the 18 where it came down initially for Wolf. That was, I didn't realize I missed it as much as I did. I had heard about Seminole Golf Club, and I've seen pictures of it and all that. What a cool course, using the natural sand dunes and all of that. What a great design.
That was beautiful, you know, and you always worry at times, Dan, because there was such a write-up about how beautiful this course was and how the course was made. And, you know, this is a chance for Seminole Country Club and golf course to shine. Make sure that while you're watching this event, you keep an eye on the golf course. And it lived up to the expectations I had put on it because of everything I had read about it. And now that's one of those courses. Listen, we all know it's difficult and to almost impossible to get on there, probably even more so now that they've had this tournament there. But now that's one of those things you put on the bucket list. I want to go play that course just because of the beauty of it, how it was built. I mean, I literally at times, Dan, I know this sounds ridiculous, but I literally got up off the couch and was watching from like 2 inches from the TV, trying to pick out specific aspects of the course. There's the driving range, there's mm-hmm. this, there's the ocean. I was like, wait, what am I doing? I mean, I can still see the same thing from 12 feet away on my couch. Why do I have to stand 6 inches from the screen?
It was interesting to see them wearing shorts, which they wouldn't have been able to do were it a PGA sanctioned event, obviously. So they're carrying their own bags. They had these smaller sort of stripped down bags that they were carrying. It was really a fascinating viewing experience. And then to see them after the 18
getting into golf carts and driving back to 17. You don't see PGA players carry their clubs. You don't see them in shorts. You don't see them in golf carts. It was really an interesting affair, but it was a long time coming to see athletes doing what they do on television.
It was a blast, but you know, I honestly can say I look at things differently. I'm a very analytical type person. I'm just constantly, you know, on YouTube, on Twitter, breaking down guys' swings. You know, I really want to get better at golf. I'm not the type of guy that, you know, I try to make all my putts. I don't necessarily live by the credo, don't make a putt, you don't have to. I want to be able to brag that I got a 6 index or a 7 index. I currently don't have that, but I want to get to that. So I try to break this down, but I'm watching these guys putt, and as much as I knew exactly what this was all about, and I thought it was a great idea. I loved watching the amount of money. I think the whole thing was awesome. But you know what I watched and what I came away with was on 18, when Dustin Johnson has that putt and he says, I'm going to make it. And
they're talking about it. Yeah, I thought he was going to. Yeah.
And he misses. And what I think, how many championships, how many tournaments would Dustin Johnson would have, how many should he have won if he was just a better putter? That's always been the weakness in his game.
Well, you could probably count them up. I mean, there was the one U.S. Open, right? There's been a couple where he's had it right there. But just like as a physical specimen, watching him come down to the ball and just seeing the speed that's generated by it, I'm actually as impressed by the fact that Rory McIlroy is about my size. He's what, 5'9"? Right? I mean, and just the fact that he, without that basketball body that Dustin Johnson has, that McIlroy is able to generate the club head speed that he does with that kind of ground up swing. I don't know how his back tolerates it, but he's close to becoming a golfing legend if he wins a couple more majors.
Well, that's just that's technique. And that's one of the things that we talked about. And this is to kind of go full circle, Dan. This is another Michael Jordan competitive story. When Michael decided it's time to work out, he first came in and worked out with us, with Al Vermeil, Eric Helen, at the Berto Center. But what he didn't realize was because Al Vermeil used a lot of the Olympic lifts, not muscle-building lifts, which we did bench press and curls, but we did more with squats. We did more with cleans. We did more with push press, what they labeled as the Olympic lifts, because Al Vermeil believed about strength, explosiveness and quickness. We did a lot of stuff on the track with parachutes and sleds and, you know, the first 10 meters and the second 10 meters and the third 10 meters. And Michael Jordan came in, and because he didn't know the techniques of doing a clean and clean and jerk, or the technique properly of a squat, he had to learn those things. You know, how strong Scotty was, or how strong Horace was, or the techniques we knew because of the time we had invested in the weight room. I think he only came like 2 or 3 times, and then he realized that the time it would take to learn the techniques, and this is just my opinion, he would never be the strongest, he would never be the fastest, so he elected to take another route because, again, he didn't feel like it was an even playing field in order for him to be the best.
Fascinating stuff, and that's we've gotten a microscope into Michael Jordan's character in a way that we didn't really know how it was going to be presented with his involvement in it, but it ended up spawning all of these stories and all of these connections that we've made because of the documentary. We've got a packed last hour starting in just a second with Scott Williams, the former Bull. He's going to join us, then Lou Kanellis of Fox 32, and then somebody you saw last night. He was the PR guy at the time, the PR guy who was ingeniously hustling Dennis Rodman through the back door and up the stairs to avoid all of us who were waiting to talk to him, Tom Smithberg, who was the Bulls' PR assistant. He's going to join us at 11:40. That is all straight ahead. Will Perdue with me. I'm Dan Bernstein, and you have the score.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.